Welcome to this bonus episode of the Sentientism podcast, a podcast about what's real and what matters. Sentientism answers those two deep questions by committing to evidence, reason, and compassion for all sentient beings. This episode is a cross post from the Two for Tea podcast, where I talk to Iona Italia about sentientism. This is probably the most challenging public conversation I've had to date about sentientism, given Iona is a Zoroastrian, meat-eating, unabashed speciesist who thinks the is-ought barrier cannot be crossed. So I hope you enjoy the debate we had. Two for Tea is a podcast about politics, culture, and society, and about how everyone is wrong apart from them, except when it comes to sentientism, where I'm clearly right and they're wrong. We discuss religion, humanism, the is-ought barrier, and many other topics. Make sure you subscribe to their podcast as well as mine. And I'd love to know what you think, as ever, so why not write a review and give some stars on your podcast platform. As ever, you can find out more about sentientism at sentientism.info or just search for the word sentientism on any social media platform. You'll be welcome in any of our global community groups. They're open to anyone interested, not just sentientists. Thank you for listening from me and from the sentient puppy at my feet, currently chewing my toes.
You're listening to Two for Tea. I'm your host, Iona Italia.
And I'm her frequent co-host, Helen Pluckrose.
This is a podcast about politics, society, science, and art.
And about how everyone is wrong apart from us.
This podcast is brought to you in association with Ario Magazine, a digital forum for calm, reasonable voices from across the political spectrum. The podcast is entirely listener-supported. To become a patron and gain access to patron-only broadcasts and other perks, support us on Patreon at 2 for Tea. Welcome to the conversation. Hello, everyone. My guest this week is Jamie Woodhouse. Jamie is a sentientist, a humanist, and a vegan who will grant rights to general artificial intelligences once we create them and they start creating each other, which sounds really terrifying. He believes in using evidence and reason and having compassion for all sentient beings. And Jamie, you're coming to us from
North London.
And I am coming to you from Buenos Aires as usual. Welcome, Jamie.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So I guess the first question is, what is sentientism? How do you define it? Reading your Ario article and your description on the Sentientist Facebook page, both of which I'll link to in the show notes, my impression was it's a combination of atheism plus veganism. That's the basis of it. It's sort of veganism plus, because you also are interested in giving rights to AIs, which I find an extremely dodgy proposition, but I guess we'll get into that. But first, how would you define it? And how did you come to know about it and become a sentientist?
Yeah, that's not a bad shorthand, because the atheism and the veganism link quite nicely. But the way I define it is by three things. It's a commitment to using evidence and applying reason in all things. And it's granting moral consideration to anything that's sentient. And in simple terms, that means anything that is able to experience, is able to suffer, is able to feel pleasure. So those are the three things. It's evidence, reason, and compassion. And those might naturally lead you to atheism and humanism and indeed veganism. So I came to it in a way, my campaigning and thinking around animal rights felt quite distinct from my thinking around atheism and humanism, and in a way sentientism brings them together. I've long thought that humanism is a deeply important force for good. You know, it's part of the masthead of your magazine, of course. And I found it frustrating that humanism isn't more often talked about as a potential answer to many of today's problems, whether it be, you know, post-truth, whether it be the challenges of identity politics, whether it be the challenges of religious privilege. So I've always, counted myself as a humanist. But there's always been that niggling concern about humanism, and the clue is in the name, that it focuses too much just on one species. And that has increasingly seemed to me like quite an arbitrary boundary that we should, if we really follow evidence and reason, if you're serious about the humanist commitment to evidence and reason, you have to think about sentience and therefore, you know, other things that are sentient.
Thanks. I want to come back to this species, the species issue later, but there are two things there which I want to unpick. I guess the first one, which we'll probably return to a little bit more later, is this idea of using evidence and reason in all domains of life. And I think that is one of the main problems that I have with sentientism, especially with, I guess, Peter Singer is kind of your founder and the eminence grise of this kind of movement. And I think Peter and quite a lot of other people involved seem to be high-functioning autists who don't have a conception of the role that emotion and feeling plays in human life. And I think that that actually damages the philosophy, makes it more unrealistic and also less compassionate, because the way we feel about things is also important.
So it's a common challenge to, I guess, atheism and secular humanism and maybe sentientism, that because it does have a quite a naturalistic worldview, it's focused on evidence and reason, that it can feel a little cold and unemotional. But that's not the intent, partly because sentience itself encompasses the full range of experiences. And in that context, emotion, intuition, you know, anything that affects the way you feel is seen as deeply important and powerful. I guess there's also a recognition that when I talk about reason, that's quite a broad definition of reason that can include intuition and emotion, but they do need to be tested and challenged against objective fact. So while it is, you know, a naturalistic viewpoint, and when we're thinking about taking decisions and trying to reduce suffering, it's not one that's blind to emotion and intuition and many of the softer things that give our lives meaning.
I just wanted to give an example of what I meant. You might not, obviously, this is an example from Peter Singer, and it might not, it's probably not something that you agree with. But when we just say we need to base things on evidence and reason, that sounds really lovely. You know, who could possibly disagree with that?
Yeah.
But some of the implications I find disturbing and really kind of inhumane, because emotion and feeling is a big part of our well-being versus our suffering.
Yes.
And I think trying to eliminate that from consideration would be the wrong thing to do. And the example that I recently heard, it was an interview with Peter Singer, and it was as so often a thought experiment. And I even have this feeling listening to the thought experiment that probably even Peter Singer wouldn't behave this way in real life if this were not just a philosophical conundrum. Because, of course, with thought experiments, there's nothing at stake. There's no skin in the game. But the thought experiment was, you're wearing a new pair of shoes that cost you $50, £50 or whatever. And if you get them wet, they'll be ruined and you don't have other shoes, you will have to replace them. You have to pay another £50 to replace them. And as you're walking along, you're walking by a pond or a lake, and you see a child drowning. Do you go in and save the child, even though that will ruin your shoes? And Singer was arguing that you should walk on past and then give the £50 that you would have spent on new shoes instead to a charity, choose a charity using the effective altruists list.
Yeah.
I think there's a charity that makes that sends mosquito nets to the third world, and it's one of the most effective at saving lives.
Yes, yeah.
Because malaria is one of the biggest worldwide killers. And with those £50, you can save 20 child's lives. So the correct thing to do is to ignore the drowning child and walk on past. So this kind of, we must always apply logic and reason, that doesn't sit well with me.
No, I can understand that. And I think using logic and reason can sometimes take you to uncomfortable places, and that's to be expected given the way our brains have developed and evolved. But in a way, and Peter does count himself as a sentientist. He's one of the people, along with Richard Rider and a couple of others, who developed the term originally. They developed it really out of the animal rights movement. And my intervention, what I've been trying to do, is to recast it explicitly as almost as an extension of humanism, so linking to that commitment around evidence and reason. What I would say, though, is that the baseline requirements of the philosophy of sentientism is actually quite simplistic. It doesn't imply you have to be an ultra utilitarian. It doesn't have to imply you need to be a, you know, apply deontological rules. It doesn't explicitly tell you how to make all of these massively complex trade-offs, or even how to interpret evidence and how to imply reason. All it asks is that you do commit to evidence and reason and grant some base level of moral consideration to everything. So there's an enormous diversity of people who might call themselves sentientists, as there are humanists, and there are lots of different philosophies within those areas that could lead you to different answers to those thought experiments. So in a way, I'm copping out a little bit. You know, I can share my personal view on that thought experiment if you like, but sentientism doesn't drive you to a hard-edged utilitarian perspective necessarily. It just says you have to at least have some base level of moral consideration for everything that is sentient. Beyond that, there's so much complexity about trade-offs and priorities and decisions that we will all continue to struggle with, probably forever.
Yeah, I think the other problem with prioritizing evidence and reason, or saying that you prioritize it, is that it can give you this false sense of security or of superiority. You know, my philosophy uses evidence and reason. Well, the other person also thinks their philosophy is based on evidence and reason. Everyone thinks that, where it's appropriate. You know, I feel that there are many domains in which evidence and reason are just irrelevant. I think, you know, when I'm dancing, how is evidence and reason sort of relevant to whether or not I'm a good dancer, for example?
Although ultimately, even your experience of dancing is grounded in, you know, a physical reality, the way your brain operates, how that generates sensations. I'm not saying it's even sensible to try and break that down, although some researchers probably are, but even that entire rich, very human experience ultimately is part of a physicalist reality that exists that generates the wonderful experiences you have. So again, because there's a commitment to evidence and reason, doesn't mean it's some sort of clinical, cold, lab-based assessment of everything. As with humanism, the idea is that we also celebrate the richness of sentient experience and all its variety. Does that make sense? I mean, but you're right. There is a danger in, you know, I guess in any sort of naturalistic philosophy, that it can lead you to, if you like, your own sort of dogma, when the whole point of this philosophy is that it's explicitly anti-dogmatic. The idea is that you, as in science or more broadly the application of reason, you are always in doubt and you are always progressively trying to get less wrong. You never reach a point of complete certainty because the evidence shifts and refines. But the hopeful thing is that while you're right, different groups or different people will always disagree about their interpretation of evidence. If we are always having a shared commitment to the fact that there is some sort of objective reality we can look at and examine, you know, differing in their interpretations of evidence and how they apply reason. But as long as there is some sort of shared commitment to facts and an objective external reality that we all share, it gives us a way of converging, discussing in a meaningful way, and maybe even agreeing over time about certain things in the moral, ethical, and scientific spaces. And many would argue that, you know, since the Enlightenment, that's largely what humanism and that commitment to evidence and reason has enabled us to do as a human race. And sentientism would just extend that to broaden our definition of who else we involve. Whereas if beliefs are based on dogmas, they are almost by definition, there is no way of reconciling them, because if you cannot challenge those dogmas based on evidence or reason, there's almost no point in having a discussion. So I'd say it's those two things. It's not a cold clinical point of view. It tries to encompass that full range of sentient experience and that shared commitment to there being some sort of objective truth and reality we share actually provides some way of us being able to communicate and collaborate.
So I'm sorry if this is going to seem like if I'm going to seem like a hostile witness during this interview, because I
feel free.
my basic attitude towards this is a great deal of skepticism. I'm sure you're used to that. Please don't take it personally.
Not at all. But it might be interesting to say, do you feel the same about secular humanism?
No. I mean, universal liberal secular humanism that's my jam, baby.
Yeah. Well, that's partly what I expect, right? And humanism at its heart has that commitment to use of evidence, application of reason, you know, respect for the scientific method. And in a way, sentientism is no different from that. It's saying we double down on exactly that same humanist commitment to evidence and reason. All we're doing here is explicitly extending the moral consideration to a wider circle of concern. So there's no real difference between sentientism and humanism when it comes to that commitment to evidence and reason.
Well, I disagree. First of all, I think the secular doesn't mean atheist, and I'm not an atheist.
Yes, yeah.
So here's the first point where we're going to disagree. So I feel that secularism implies that every person is free to practice their religion or to have no religion without persecution or discrimination.
Absolutely.
But you cannot force your religious views on other people. And that includes things like, I don't know, having your son circumcised or making your daughter marry at age 14 or whatever else it might be. You can't force your beliefs upon anybody else, especially not in any irreversible way. But what you yourself believe and practice should be of no concern to anybody else. If you choose to wear hijab, that's fine by me, as long as hijab is not mandated. If if I choose to go to the Aguiari, how does that affect anyone else's life? And why would you want to control what is going on inside my head, what I'm believing or feeling or not believing or feeling? I can see why you would want to not control, but you'd want to make sure that my actions were ethical. And of course, my freedom ends where someone else's freedom begins. But I don't know why it's important what you actually believe.
And in a way, as long as your actions comply with, human and animal rights considerations that we've agreed on, absolutely. So I totally agree, right? So I'm a secularist as well. Secularism and humanism are different things. And most humanists want a secularist, want a secular society for the reasons you talked about. And I'd argue, that the best defense for any freedom of religious belief is to live in a secular society, because by definition, the state is neutral to any religion and therefore supports the freedom of belief. So they're distinct. But I guess my point about humanism, and there are different interpretations of it, but if you look at the International Humanist and Ethical Union or the UK humanist definitions, they are explicitly not theistic organizations, and they do not accept supernatural views of reality. So that's an essential part of what, I guess the definition of humanism I'm using is that it doesn't say no one should be religious, but it says if you call yourself a humanist, a humanist in this context, it means you personally just do not have supernatural views.
Yeah, well, also we need to, if we're going to have a shared ethics, we can't base that on the supernatural. Because I can't tell you should do this because my religion tells you to, because you're not a member of my religion.
Yeah. And I would argue even if somebody else is a member of that religion, it still doesn't justify you causing them unnecessary harm or suffering.
Right, but it also doesn't make any sense that something would be only applicable to members of your religion and not to everybody. You know, if you want to have a universal ethics, you can't base it on specific religious teachings.
Yes, yeah, I agree. So, and I think, you know, that I'd completely agree with that philosophy. It's about secular government, state laws, and human rights. But humanism and sentientism as philosophies that people may or may not choose to adopt are explicitly non-theistic and are not based on supernatural views. And they would argue that if your concern is for either, you know, equally all other humans or more broadly the suffering or the well-being of other sentient beings, of all sentient beings, including humans, then our decisions about morals and ethics should be based on that suffering and that well-being and, you know, our evidence and thinking about the likely impacts of those things, rather than some other supernatural or revealed rationale for our ethical decisions.
Of course. And also, being an atheist is often courageous, depends on where you are in the world. And
very much so. Yeah.
It's a position of integrity. You know, I can't see how there's any moral superiority to believing in a god or gods versus not believing, because belief is not voluntary.
Although it can be, in a way, that's part of what humanism and sentientism are trying to say, is you can choose what to believe in based on evidence and application of reason. So my beliefs have changed, you know, over the years.
Within the non-supernatural realm.
My beliefs about the supernatural realm have also changed as well. And I was brought up, you know, believing, you know, in a fairly bland version of Christianity, and through the application of reason and searching for evidence and reading widely, I deliberately changed my belief on that basis.
Right. I find that really odd.
It's remarkably common.
It's remarkably common for people to lose their belief, but to just say, I choose not to believe, I find that really odd. You either believe something or you don't. For example, I look out the window, I believe it's a sunny day today here in Buenos Aires. I can't just make myself decide that I believe it's raining.
No, I can. I agree. Although you're believing it's sunny because of the evidence that's reaching your senses that it's sunny. We could get into a discussion about determinism and free will, and that you have you know, in that sense, you have no choice but to believe what is presented to you. But in the common sense, illusory version of free will, you know, we do look at evidence and decide what to believe and what not to believe. And oddly, the people who are explicitly taking a decision to believe things for which there is no evidence, you know, it's really clear they're taking a decision to believe that because there is no valid evidence for those things.
Yeah, I'm still pretty skeptical about whether you can really choose to believe or not. So, you know, if you wanted to believe in Thor and Odin and things like that right now, would you be able to? Because I would not. That's what I mean when I say that I don't think belief is voluntary. So it makes no sense to me to see atheism versus belief as a moral issue.
Yeah, I guess I'd be interested in how you think beliefs are formed if you don't choose them. Again, in a hard version of, you know, looking at free will, everything is deterministic, so we have no real choice about anything. But exposure to, exposure to evidence and application of reason drives you to a conclusion. I mean, that's just the nature of thought and discussion and argument, and, you know, people's minds do change.
Well, no, I disagree, because people discuss and argue all the time and reach different conclusions.
Yeah, but often they do over time manage to converge. I mean, that, you know, if you took a sort of Pinkerian view of human progress, that's almost the essential thing that's helped us get to where we are today.
Yeah, I still don't think that you can just choose to believe whatever you like. You know, if you tell me the moon is made of green cheese, I just cannot choose to believe that. And of course, I've never been to one. I don't have hard and fast evidence, but
you are a Zoroastrian.
Yeah, I am. Yeah.
And I think that's an interesting example in that you're right. If someone says, you know, the moon is made of green cheese, I could not possibly believe that because there is no evidence for it. Yet billions of people around the world believe things that are even more outlandish than the moon being made of green cheese with as much evidence.
Right, with no evidence, because they're not things that are falsifiable. So it's not part, it's not...
And I agree, right? It's not necessarily falsifiable, but at the same time, there are an infinite number of things for which there is no evidence. So any decision to choose between them is completely arbitrary, and I would argue pointless.
I guess I should move on quickly from this. I don't want to spend too much time on this question, but you say that evidence and reason underlie both viewpoints, atheism and veganism. And of course, I have read Sam Harris's book, The Moral Landscape, and I'm familiar with his idea that science can produce human values, and his values are based, and it's a very sentientist viewpoint, even though he is certainly not a sentientist. He is not even vegetarian.
Yeah, it's interesting because in a way, sentientism could be a name for the philosophy he puts forward in the
right,
moral
but
landscape.
Go ahead. I interrupted you.
He explicitly does grant moral consideration to non-human animals that are sentient. He just, he doesn't take the step of then applying that to the decisions he takes in his daily life.
Well, I think everybody grants, almost everyone grants moral worth value to non-human animals. The question is whether we grant them equal value to humans or not. But so in The Moral Landscape, his thesis, in case anyone here isn't familiar with it, is that morality is based on the fact that the one thing that I can be sure of is that I exist. I don't know about you. You could be just a hallucination. Maybe I've just forgotten to take my schizophrenia drugs and there's actually nobody on the other end there. Or
yes,
maybe, I'm part of some simulation, some aliens are playing a computer game and I'm some avatar within the game. I think that's much less likely.
Yeah, and I'm a non-player character.
Yes, maybe I'm just a brain in a vat or whatever it might be. But I have a consciousness and I'm able to suffer and I'm able to feel happiness and I'm able to feel suffering. And so therefore, I want to increase happiness, minimize suffering. And I might as well assume that everybody else within their own heads is also experiencing the same thing, the same consciousness, and they want happiness and to increase happiness and minimize suffering. And therefore, the logical thing to do is for me to behave in a way that will increase other people's happiness and decrease their suffering.
Yes.
But I think that is still trying to go from an is to an ought, even in Sam Harris's view, because of course there are psychopaths and sociopaths out there who say, well, the only thing that matters to me is my own pleasure. I don't care about other people's suffering, and maybe their suffering even gives me more pleasure. So this kind of viewpoint doesn't actually, what's missing is why we should behave in the moral way. And I don't think religion has the answer to that at all. Yeah. But the answer to that is not simply, it's not simply a logical deduction. There's another step there. And that step is much greater when you get to sentientism. So you say evidence and reason underlie both viewpoints. This is from your Ario magazine article. You say evidence and reason underlie both atheism and veganism. But one of those is about logic and the other is about ethics. You're kind of roping an is and an ought together. So my personal feeling is I don't think it would be good if everyone were vegan for reasons for ecological reasons. I think that would be probably not the optimum. But almost certainly, let's say more people could become vegans, and that would probably be a good thing for the planet. But to become a vegan is a sacrifice. I was vegan I did veganism for a year a few years ago, and it was really quite a miserable experience. I was craving meat and dairy almost every day.
Yeah.
For an entire year. And I really, I did have a vegetable coconut milk curry that I made, which I quite enjoyed. But most of my eating experiences were really quite unpleasant. The food was very unpalatable and I was kind of choking down food. And very often I also had to go hungry because there was no vegan option. And so, you know, my friends would be eating something delicious and I would be ravenous. This would be in between dance class and going dancing. And I'd be eating tomatoes, lettuce, and onions with a little bit of drizzle of olive oil and a slice of white Wonder Bread, because those were the only vegan things that the restaurant had very frequently. And it felt so unsatisfying.
Well, and you're at real risk, and I know you've had this before, of getting a Twitter storm of feedback on dietary options. Can we go back to the is and the ought thing and then the environmental stuff first? And then it would be good to come on to how much sacrifice is it really to follow through on those implications? Because to my mind, I'm similar to Sam, really. I'm not that concerned about the is ought boundary, partly because the logic flow for me goes, I experience suffering. I experience suffering as a qualitatively negative thing. I mean, that's almost the definition of suffering. From observing others, humans and animals, from their behavior and, from scientific research into the way their nervous systems work, I'm not 100% sure they experience suffering, but I am overwhelmingly confident they do, as are most people.
Right.
And then if morality is anything, morality is is making decisions about what is good and bad, and morality is deciding what we ought to do, and suffering is bad, and morality is about avoiding the bad, therefore it is moral to avoid suffering. And that entire statement didn't involve any oughts at all. So
it is moral. That's an ought.
But morality itself is about working out what we ought to do to avoid suffering. So it's almost definitional that it's included. And I agree, you could take a decision to...
I disagree, but I think we can just... This is a point for philosophers and we need to talk about it.
And I'm not one of those. So, but I guess then the next stage would be, in general, if people don't have to make a sacrifice and they don't see other negative side effects, they would prefer not to cause suffering to other things. So, that's partly because we've evolved that way. We've evolved empathy. We've evolved compassion. It's partly, there are arguments about reciprocity and the evolution of cooperation that have also led us to feel that way. And part of the reason, I do care about the suffering of others is because it makes me feel better personally. It improves my own experience to believe that and to operate in that way. So I guess that sort of links together this sense of, why should we care about the suffering of others? But there is still a question there about what degree of sacrifice do we make? And there's, all sorts of open questions about trade-offs and decisions there that people will continue to disagree on. And that includes on the subject of veganism. I guess my personal perspective, and the reason most sentientists tend towards veganism, not all by any means, but most of them tend that direction. And I'd argue if, you really want to reduce your level of hypocrisy and cognitive dissonance, that's probably, you'll end up somewhere in that space, is because from what you've said, that sounds like an uncomfortable position to be in, but it feels very unusual to me from the experiences of other people I've talked to. For most people, there are viable, easy, healthy alternatives that mean they don't have to make a substantial sacrifice. And when you put that on the scales against the industrial scale suffering caused, for many people, that leads them to, a vegan stance or something very similar to it. And interestingly, part of the reason that veganism seems to have become much more, a la mode in the last year or so, one is because the alternatives are getting better and better and better all the time. We've always had fruit and vegetables and those other types of alternatives. But when you look at the plant-based alternatives, the application of technology, you'll see some of the clean meat products coming through faster and faster. The amount of sacrifice you have to make personally, I would argue, is minimal already and is rapidly zooming into zero. The other reason it seems to have picked up is because...
If you live in the first world, so you have all these posh options, available to you...
Some of the modern meat alternatives, you're right, at the moment aren't fully accessible and are more expensive than meat and dairy products. In some cases they don't. The availability isn't there. So I think that will change very rapidly. You can already see that, you know, with the Impossible Burger and going into commercial outlets, they're doing that at a neutral price point. I think the availability globally will improve. But even today, if you go to almost any market, you know, even in a rural area or any supermarket, the cheapest foods by kilogram will largely be beans, pulses, fruits and vegetables. So I know that doesn't work for everybody because some people struggle more than others and they need the modern alternatives. But even in the meantime, generally, for many people around the world, you know, a non-meat and dairy diet is actually more cost effective.
Of course. Yeah, of course. It's not about cost. It's really about a sort of palatability. So I had beans and rice every single day during the year that I was a vegan, pretty much. And I did get incredibly bored of eating that. And also, I did not, you know, I felt noticeably less well. I was much tireder. I had really bad stomach aches and bloating. I did not feel, and I had bad skin. I did not feel at all good during that year. Yeah. I'm just going to put it to you like this. I mean, I know that some people do feel very healthy and good on it, on yeah. vegan diet, but I did not. And, you know, I am 50. I don't have a pension plan. I'm poor. You know, I work as a freelance yeah. writer and editor and things. So I have to work and be healthy until the day I die. Yeah. And so I do not want to gamble with something that's not optimal for health. And I definitely don't want to eat meat substitute products, which look to me really unhealthy. Those kind of vegan frankenfoods. That's not what I'm interested in.
Well, interestingly, they're engineered explicitly to be radically less environmentally destructive and more healthy because the technology means you can tune and adapt and make them in essentially clean lab environments. Whereas I won't talk through it now, but if you look into the reality of the meat and dairy industry, you'll very rapidly develop an understanding of the reality of how that food is produced.
I know it's horrible. I know it's produced in a horrible way. And I think that...
And I'm not just talking ethically either. I'm talking...
Of course, sure.
In terms of what's actually in the foods as well.
Sure, but I'm not going to then eat vegetable oils and kind of texturized, rehydrogenized and these kind of engineered foods, I think are also probably not the best idea.
Well, I'm not a doctor and I'm not a dietitian, so I'm going to resist the temptation to give you advice. What I would say is that I think your situation that sounds really unpleasant. It seems very unusual to me because I haven't come across many people who really genuinely suffer from making that switch. It may be true for some people, but the vast majority of people I've come across and the evidence base that I've seen in the research shows that nearly everybody can survive very healthily on a sensible vegan diet. And there's some great resources if you look at like the Vegan Society and so on. It talks about because essentially it's about the nutrients. It's not about whether it's meat or dairy or plants. It's about the nutrients. As long as you get those right nutrients and you can get all of them from plant-based sources, you can live a healthy life. But the other point that you mentioned, which is important, is the environmental aspect. And I think that's another reason why this has become much more topical in the last year. Partly because of the research around the environmental impact of the animal farming industry, and by some measures, it's, you know, as serious or almost as serious as all of transport globally because of the emissions and the land use and the water use. Yeah, so even if people aren't concerned about suffering at all, the environmental
which of course they are. I mean, don't demonize people.
I wouldn't think to demonize. I'm just saying in a thought experiment where you imagine, you know, that's okay. Just not a consideration for you at all. The environmental argument around bringing an end to animal farming is also overwhelming, partly because it has a 10 times inefficiency gap with arable farming. If you take an acre of plants and use them for calories for humans, you will get 10 times, you will feed 10 times as many people as if you take those plants, feed them to animals and then feed the animals to humans. Every step through that, you know, circle of life, if you like, you lose 80 to 90% of the calorific efficiency. And that's partly what drives the massive environmental impact of animal farming. And it's interesting because you've raised this point a few times, right? Most people do care about animal suffering. The Sentience Institute has done some really interesting research recently that shows that almost half of US consumers actually disagree with factory farming and, you know, would like slaughterhouses banned. So there is a massive latent groundswell of opinion that in philosophical terms agrees with me that suffering is bad, that the environmental damage is bad. But there's such a deep taboo and a deep societal traditional lock around consuming meat and dairy that's just preventing billions of people from taking that next step and bringing their actions a little more in line with their beliefs, which is very frustrating to people who are involved in these movements, but it can also lead to, you know, a little stridency that then puts people off. So it's a tricky balance because it's such an important topic.
Well, I'm not an expert on the environmental stuff, but I think that an only plant-based agriculture would not be the ideal. And I am concerned about giant monoculture farms. Yes.
Well, you can still have a massive rich diversity. You can have a massive rich diversity of plant-based farming. The main reason we have massive industrial monocultures is because where we do grow plants, so much of them are used for animal feed. So actually, if we can transition to end animal farming, we'll end up with a much more diverse range of plant farming than we do today, where so much of our plants are fed to animals. Mm.
I'm unconvinced by that, but I don't have, you know, I don't have the facts and expertise. So.
I will share some reading.
You can share some reading, and I'll put that in the show notes. I take your point, and very rarely eat chicken because when I eat beef, I can eat grass-fed beef. So in Argentina, still a lot of our beef is pastured. A lot of our cows are on pastures, not in a feedlot. And I want to avoid or minimize eating feedlot beef. I think feedlots are an abomination. And yes. But there's no real equivalent of that for chickens. And so I do eat eggs, however, but I've stopped eating chicken. I very rarely eat chicken.
Yeah, many people are following that path. I mean, you know, I guess I and many others have taken it to a point around ceasing to eat meat and dairy completely, but many people are reducing in different ways. And that's interesting logic, right? So one is, you know, what's the condition of the animals are kept in? Another is, simply speaking, the size of the animals in that you cause more deaths per meal by eating chickens than you do by eating beef. But again, there are some real difficulties here because most people, I think, disagree with factory farming, and many people, I mean, you clearly, you know, do consume grass-fed beef, but most people seem to claim that they don't participate in factory farmed food. But the reality is that in the US, 99% of meat and dairy is factory farmed, and globally it's around 90%. So nearly all of our meat and dairy is factory farmed, whether people like it or not, and they don't.
Right.
But again, then you're left with this, okay, so, you know, so what? And that's where most people stop because, again, the taboo and the tradition, you know, holds people pretty tight. And in a way, that commitment to, you know, continuing to eat meat and dairy, to me, feels quite like the commitment to sticking with a religion, even though the evidence, you know, should point you a different direction. There's an interesting parallel there.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is more to food than just what's the most logical way of nourishing. So I think it's, there's also vitality and pleasure are both factors.
Yes, absolutely.
And
the experience of us as sentient humans in, you know, what we eat is a part of the equation as well, right? How important that is compared to the suffering, you can debate, but that is an important part.
Yeah, and I agree that culture also plays a role, and in fact also religion.
Yeah.
Since, you know, I lived in India where I think about half of Indians are vegetarians.
It's certainly a very high proportion.
Yeah, I think it's about half. And Indian vegetarians don't eat eggs, of course. So they're a little, they do eat dairy products, but no eggs. So it's a little closer to veganism.
And interestingly, if you go back into the history of vegetarianism, the word actually meant vegan. It was only, you know, in later decades when there was a little bit of a divergence around dairy and dairy products and eggs.
I do think that the future will probably not be these Franken meat products, but more like lab-grown, cell-based meats, like the Memphis Meat Project.
My only appeal there would be not to get sucked into this sort of nature is good, artificial is bad fallacy, and again, just follow the science and the evidence, because a lot of the plant-based products and the cell-based products that are coming through, they are explicitly being designed to be more healthy and radically less environmentally destructive. That's exactly the point of those products. So I'm not going to claim they're perfect. I'm not going to claim they don't have issues or risks, or they have their own environmental impact. But the entire point of the people driving the design of these products is to make them cheaper, more compelling, tastier, and less destructive than meat and dairy. And, you know, the evidence, we should follow the evidence as to whether they succeed, but the early indications are very good.
Yeah. So, Jamie, I want to move on, but I'll just say very briefly that this healthier, they're engineering them to be healthier. In nutrition, there is absolutely zero consensus. I think the only thing that maybe 90% of or 95% of people agree is that we should eat vegetables. Yeah. And beyond that, there is zero consensus. So
it's a pretty weak field, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's extreme.
Considering how important it is to us.
It's an extremely weak field. Basically, we have no idea what's healthy and what isn't healthy. Is it healthy to eat whole grains? We don't know. Some people say yes. Some people say don't eat them at all. Is it healthy to eat pulses? We don't know. Is it healthy to eat a lot of saturated fat? We don't know. Some people say no. Some people say yes. Some people say you should eat low fat, and some people say 80% of your calories should come from saturated fat. I mean, that is the state of nutrition advice.
I agree. It's weak. And I don't, some people will use health as a primary argument for giving up meat and dairy. And I don't do that. And I don't think the science supports it either. I think the evidence I've seen, such as it is that, you know, a healthy vegan or vegetarian diet is better than the average diet, but that is a very low bar to set because you can also have a very healthy diet that does have meat and dairy. So I think, for me, it's very much about ethics and animal suffering and environmental impact second. Mm. And the health thing, as long as it doesn't require a sacrifice, that's very much a distant third for me at the moment. And we need a lot more research to really understand in depth.
So I want to get to the animal suffering now, not specifically with veganism, but in general. So I think there's no doubt that we are causing a huge amount of animal suffering that could be avoided. I'm not sure that the way that we eat is even the primary cause of that. There's also habitat destruction. There's pollution. There's all kinds of ways in which we are causing massive suffering to animals. I don't think there can be any doubt about that. But where I differ from the sentientist thing is that this idea that, first of all, the idea that animals and humans are morally equivalent. Yeah. And secondly, the AI, which we'll also, I think, get to maybe at the end. So let me just read something that you wrote. The sentientist position, or at least my conception of it, allows us to grant different degrees of moral consideration depending on where on the sentient spectrum something lies. And that's the kind of logic that Peter Singer uses in his concept of personhood. And I find I don't agree with this concept of personhood. I think the species is a hard boundary for me, humans, and then afterwards dogs, I will put in second position. Yeah. I'm unabashedly speciesist. You know, I think a dog's life is worth more than the life of a cockroach. And a human's life is worth even more than the life of a dog. I say that with a little bit of kind of caution as you might know, or you might have picked up, that dogs are sacred in Zoroastrianism. For us, they are the
most... We have a new puppy in the house.
Oh.
I'm with you.
So I'm sure I'm sure you agree with me on that one. In fact, it's the one point of Zoroastrianism that I can usually get people to agree on. Dogs are sacred. I think Eckhart Tolle says that dogs are ambassadors of being or something. ambassadors of pure being, he calls them. But of course, Singer's idea that it's about the degree of sentience leads to some really tricky ethical questions. And some of them, in Singer's case, I think sometimes I feel he's just trolling. You know, he says infants aren't fully sentient, so it should be okay to, if you choose to, as the parents, obviously you need to have good reason, but it should be legal for you to kill your infant because they don't have full sentience. You know, the logical corollary to that would be you can kill somebody when they're under general anesthetic having an operation because at that moment they're also not sentient because infants will have obviously grow up to have full human sentience, yeah. Or most will. And if we're trying to choose and we're choosing based on degree of sentience, then we're going to consider some people within our own species not sentient and not full people, and we're not going to grant them the same rights. And that makes me extremely uncomfortable.
And that's partly why the way I'm framing sentientism, it almost deliberately leaves these sort of interesting edge cases and thought experiments for others to fight over. All it claims is that if a being is sentient, you need to grant it some degree of moral consideration. Over and above that, you know, you can continue to have these battles. So for myself, I would agree with your categorization of cockroach, dog, and human, if you like. But that's not just because of the species they fit into. That is because it's my somewhat scientific understanding of their degree or their level of sentience. And there's a lot more research that needs to be done there around what species are or aren't sentient. You know, does it make sense to have degrees of sentience? Does it even make sense to compare, you know, different species levels of sentience at all? But I don't subscribe to this binary conception where everything sentient should be accorded the same level of right and moral consideration. I do think it makes sense that there probably are some things that have a lower level of sentience than others that are higher, partly because, you know, as a fairly hard determinist, sentience to me is just a class of very advanced information processing. And that could be super advanced or it could be reasonably basic but still sentient, and I think it makes sense to be able to grade our moral consideration. But generally, most sentientists, even at the very basic level where something has even some rudimentary level of sentience, where it has any sort of sense of experience whatsoever, they would still grant enough moral consideration to that being that they would want to avoid its suffering or its death. So just because, you know, a human might have slightly less sentience than another human doesn't mean you have the right to kill it or harm it. It's still sentient. You still need to grant it moral consideration. You still need to grant it rights. So I'm not too concerned about these sort of philosophical edge cases. I'm more focused on that simple baseline and then the really clear, obvious, egregious harms that we do deliberately cause to, you know, hundreds of billions of sentient things, humans and animals.
Mm.
So hopefully that doesn't sound like I'm copping out of some of the tricky philosophy, but I'm really just trying to set a very simple, simplistic baseline.
No, it's fine. I hate philosophy, actually.
Much of it, to me, much of it is insular. Much of it is too semantic and doesn't necessarily engage with the real world. And again, that's why, you know, this very simplistic baseline that helps us focus on the really obvious, egregious harms we're causing, it feels to me a more important place to focus.
Mm.
And that's partly what I'm trying to do with building a bit of a movement and a community around this idea, is to try and draw that link between pragmatic philosophy and the real world a little bit more directly, mm. rather than getting lost in, you know, stuff that's too abstruse.
In these trolley problem style kind of,
yeah.
You have to choose between the life of a gorilla and the life of your four-year-old. Peter Singer says you should choose the gorilla. That kind of stuff.
Those are fascinating debates, right? And I'm sure people enjoy them. But there are some really basic, obvious harms to humans and non-human sentient animals that we are causing right now that are blindingly obvious, and we should focus on those first. And when we fixed all of those problems, you know, then we can come back to these trolley problems and the edge cases and the really tricky stuff.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I was quite interested in and I'm a little terrified by your idea of granting moral consideration to AIs.
Yeah.
And there are two opposing models of this. There's the Star Trek model, in which you have data. If you've seen the Star Trek episode Measure of a Man, have you watched that?
Yes. Yeah.
So it's clear that Data ought to be granted full personhood and moral consideration. And in general, mostly in Trek, when we have an AI becoming sentient, it's usually benevolent or at least neutral. There's this computer program that becomes sentient in Deep Space Nine. And I think Miles ends up trapping it in a sub-program and feeding it various bits of information to keep it happy. And he describes it as the puppy. It's very cuddly. And, you know, also those lights that become sentient in Next Generation. And you can tell they're sentient because they address Picard and the others as big, ugly bags of mostly water.
Yeah. Saggy, wet bags of flesh. Yeah.
But there's also the. But I have also watched Battlestar Galactica. You know, there's also the Battlestar Galactica model, the Cylons, that the AI may well be sentient, but amoral.
Yeah.
You know, it may be a paperclip maximizer ready to destroy the entire planet in order. If by doing so it can make more paperclips.
Yeah. And unfortunately, just because you grant moral consideration to something doesn't mean you don't sometimes have to constrain, harm, or even kill it if it plans to do evil. as applies with humans, right? We still have moral consideration for murderers and rapists, but that, you know, we are absolutely still justified in punishing and constraining them.
Right, but we don't, if our species were entirely murderers and rapists, then there would be an argument for genocide. And so, you know, I think there is an argument for our genocide of AIs.
Potentially so, but I think you'd argue that presumably based on a balance of, you know, the likely suffering that could be caused if you don't go ahead with it. And I do want to apologize here to the, you know, the those who are involved in the sentientism community with me, because many of them find the discussion and the inclusion of artificial intelligence is, you know, at best a distraction and at worst, you know, an irrelevance. Because again, you know, the problems we're facing right now today, given the harms we cause to humans and non-human animals, are so obvious and egregious that those need to be the immediate focus. The reason I do still include that concept in sentientism is, one, just because it's just an implication of us focusing on what matters morally, and what matters morally is the ability to suffer. So if there is another type of thing that is able to suffer, you know, we should grant it moral consideration. It's also because, it comes back to, again, that fairly hard determinist view, that in a way, sentientism and consciousness more generally, to me, are just classes of extremely advanced information processing. So, you know, whether that's runs on a biology or whether that runs on some other substrate, morally, I don't really see a distinction. Now, I'm pretty neutral on whether we're on the brink of an artificial general intelligence singularity, or whether it's something that will take hundreds of years. And in a sense, I'm not, you know, I'm neutral on that. I find it fascinating in a different context, but I don't see it as an immediate imperative for sentientism. But I do like the fact that sentientism as a philosophy is ready for that eventuality. And if you want to get even weirder, you know, you could even think about sentient aliens if we ever come to encounter them as well. So, you know, the priority is absolutely about humans and non-human sentient animals, because we know they exist. They're here now. There are hundreds of billions of them, and we're causing obvious harms to them. But conceptually, I quite like the idea that the philosophy isn't defined by somewhat arbitrary species boundaries, and it focuses on that characteristic of sentience that is the whole reason you would ever care about something morally. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. I tried this argument actually on Nicholas Christakis when he was on this podcast.
Yeah, that was a fascinating episode, and it felt almost like you were talking about sentientism without mentioning the word.
And as you remember, he was quite skeptical. You know, he said that any aliens who are able to come here, who are able to communicate with us or find our planet, given the technology that they would require to do that, would be so far in advance of us that they would not really consider us to be sentient, basically, because their conception of sentience would involve so much more sophistication.
Maybe, but I think their sophistication would lead them to acknowledge that we do suffer and we do experience pain and pleasure, and I think they would probably have a deeper understanding of that than we do. And so I would hope that, you know, seems a bit silly to say, but if we do encounter aliens or create artificial general intelligences, I hope they're sentientists, because if they are, they'll look after us much better than we look after non-human animals. So I've joked before that part of the reason, you know, I like this philosophy is because, you know, hopefully we can encourage our future AGI overlords or alien masters to adopt the philosophy as well. It could be our salvation.
Well, I did always like the way that in Babylon 5, that instead of talking about humanoids, they call them sentients. So they say, you know, this planet is inhabited by 5 billion sentients.
Yeah.
Which I really like.
Me too. And for me, humans are still the most important sentients, if you like, right? You know, I prioritize them.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I definitely do too, but I think that for me, at least, the species boundary is a hard boundary. Mm. The person who is human, except in some very extreme circumstances, like they're brain dead or acephalic or someone who has very, very severe mental disabilities where you really question their actual sentience. But beyond that, there's a hard boundary for me, humans over other animals. Yeah. That is.
And I would agree with you. And I'd agree based on an uncertain scientific view that we have a higher degree or a richer sentience than other species, whereas you would take that stance just because we're humans. In a way, I think we sort of agree on for slightly different reasons.
Yeah. And then dogs next. But that's for completely irrational reasons. I still feel a dog's life is more important than the life of any other animal. Well, except for a species that's endangered, I guess. But I don't, you know, for one of the things that leads to is that although I certainly think we should minimize animal suffering, and talking of Star Trek, one of the things that they say is that they're kind of slightly horrified by the fact that the Klingons still eat real animals rather than synthesized meat, and humans stopped eating actual animals centuries ago. And, you know, I think that is the direction that I would like to see us go in. I would like to see the Memphis Meat Project or something similar to that work. And I would be totally happy to eat farmed meat that was farmed from cells in the lab.
Yes.
But I'd also be happy to eat meat that was from animals that lived in good circumstances on farms. And, you know, I think that there is use for natural manure rather than artificial fertilizers. And there are reasons for keeping animals, farm animals around, in my opinion. And if the farm animals are cared for, I'm happy to have them raised to be killed. And that is a hard difference between that and humans.
It is, yeah, absolutely. And I think, one, if you just need manure from animals, you'll get more of it. Manure from animals, you'll get more of it if you keep them alive. Two, you know, I agree with this idea of allowing an animal to live a long, healthy, happy life and then killing it, but that just isn't the reality of, you know, 95% to 99% of animals.
Of course, no, it's not.
But I would, even then, even if you have an animal that isn't killed, you know, very early in its lifespan with suffering, even if you could find some enormously ethical, healthy way of having long, happy lives, I would still have an ethical objection to ending that sentient thing's life without its consent.
Right. That's where we differ. But it's, as you say.
But again, we're, But again, with this is one of the interesting things is that most non-vegans actually agree with most vegans about factory farming and animal farming, which is 90% of the animal industry at the moment. So actually, you know, it often doesn't feel like it in public debates, but there's an enormous degree of consistency and agreement around factory farming that we could all focus on together. And again, you know, once we've worked through that, we can discuss the ethics of Argentinian grass-fed beef, you know, that 0.5% of the animal industry later. Yeah. But we can focus together on the horrors of factory farming right now, because the numbers are absolutely breathtaking. Some of the Sentient Institute's research has estimated that somewhere over 100 billion animals are, you know, bred, farmed and killed every single year for meat and dairy. And that's an underestimate, you know, given fish. But so the scale is just breathtaking.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all, I think that we all understand that the one of the problems is that we live with cognitive dissonance at many, many levels in our lives.
Yes, we all have it.
And it's not just, but it's not restricted to our eating habits. It's, you know, the clothes I'm wearing, were they made in a sweatshop somewhere? Is child labor being exploited for this? Is it actually even good that there's a sweatshop there, because the alternative would be prostitution for those children? Or, you know, we are so, so interconnected, and our actions all have kind of ethical implications. In a sense, the ethical thing to do, since our planet is very overpopulated and I am not a person who makes a huge impact on the world, you know, the ethical thing to do would be to kill myself now while I'm only 50 and some of my organs are in good shape and I am a card-carrying donor. And,
what I would encourage you to do is I value my own scenting experience higher than anybody else's or anything
right,
else's.
Me too.
So I'm certainly not, I'm certainly not going to consider doing that.
Yeah, of course. But, you know, we do live with a continual cognitive dissonance. So I think it's not so surprising that we have this cognitive dissonance around eating.
No.
It's not that we don't know what is happening in the slaughterhouse as we're eating our steak. We know that and we think that is horrible. But we just put it out of our heads because, like so many other things, we put out of our heads because there are so many bad impacts we're having, you know, throughout life.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a complex world, right? And nobody lives a perfect ethical life. It's just not possible to do. You know, the production of arable foods causes harm to animals as well, right? You know, there's no way of living a life with zero suffering caused. But all I would say is, just because cognitive dissonance is common and because, you know, these philosophical choices are hard, doesn't mean we should use that as an excuse for not trying. So, you know, I have cognitive dissonances. I have plenty of them. But I think it's a good thing to try and reduce them if you can. Whereas some people say, you know, we all have cognitive dissonance, so I'm not even going to evaluate myself. I'm not even going to think about my own decisions. I'm not even going to try to progress. And I find that, you know, odd. I don't think the commonality of cognitive dissonances should be used as an excuse for not trying to improve. Mm.
Okay, I have a few questions from Twitter. I think some of them you have answered, and some of them want to get into these philosophical games, which you don't want to get into. I'm not sure that actually, do people enjoy these games? Yes and no. I mean, Peter Singer is possibly the most hated person on earth. He's treated like Hitler in person by a lot of people. I mean, I do think Peter Singer has autism. I think he just doesn't understand emotions, and that's his main problem. He's trying to get at things from a purely rational point of view. But, you know, I think that people both want to play these games and also they get very, very emotionally upset playing them.
Yes, I agree. And I think, I mean, some of them are intellectually interesting, but they're also very emotive. So it does become quite painful.
Yes.
Quite a lot of the questions, particularly on the animal rights side, the motivation is quite transparent. So, you know, it's fascinating to talk about the suffering of wild animals. It's fascinating to talk about, you know, is a lion immoral? It's fascinating to talk about, you know, what happens if I'm stuck on an island with a chicken, you know, and I'm happy to answer all those questions. But the reality of, you know, the main central element of the veganism and vegetarianism movement is we breed and kill 100 billion animals every year for our food and drink in a way that, you know, is unconscionable. So all of the interesting conversations around, chickens on desert islands and, the ethics of wild animals, again, they're sort of interesting questions, but they're really diversions away from the central cognitive dissonance that most people just don't want to face.
I think the other thing where I have a kind of hard species boundary ethically is that although I am concerned about the suffering of farm animals, I'm much more concerned about tigers being killed or loss of habitat. I'm much more concerned about the fact that they want to build a metro station in Aray Forest outside Bombay. Yeah. If any of you want to go and sign the petition to save Aray Forest, please do. And I'll link to my description of the Bombay Forest in the show notes, so you can read about it. It's a magical and unique place. And because those things are unique, and this is where my Pinkerian optimism that I generally have about other things falls down, because in the case of animal suffering, that's awful. But I think that we can probably find technological ways to solve this in the future that are cheaper, and therefore, people will do them because they're cheaper, and the nudge will be in that direction towards meat, farmed meat or whatever it might be. But if tigers are gone, they're gone. And I don't think we're going to, well, maybe in some future we'll have a Jurassic Park style situation where we can re-engineer them. That would be wonderful. That would be the ideal. But as far as I can see at the moment, those things cannot, if Aray Forest is gone, it's gone. If tigers are gone from India, they're gone. And so I am much more concerned about that than I am about the suffering of chickens. And that again is a hard species boundary. That implies that I don't care that much about chickens.
And I, because I care about those things too.
Of course.
The reason I care about them is because of the impact on sentient creatures. So I care about the experience of those individual tigers and their suffering. I care about what the biodiversity loss might mean for future generations of humans and medicines and various other things, and the pleasure those things give to, the animals that live in those environments and the humans that experience them as well. So I don't grant moral consideration to the forest itself or to the species of tiger, because neither of those things can suffer. But I empathize with, and I share your concern for those things, but because of their impact on this sentient experience of humans and non-human animals. So quite often there is a very strong overlap in the environmental space. But again, most people care more about species than they do about individual animal suffering. They care more about generically, the charismatic environment and charismatic animals and trophy hunting and fur, but don't engage with the details of the animal farming industry. And again, I can understand why that might be because of how we've grown up and tradition and so on. But if you look at the raw hard facts, it does lead you to a very different place ethically. But, I think there is a massive overlap on the environmental concerns generally.
I think so. My concern with trophy hunting is, again, the scarcity factor. I'm not at all, I feel no outrage at all about people hunting deer. In fact, my sister, who is a lifelong vegetarian, eats venison. It's the only meat that she eats because the venison are culled. These are wild living venison who are shot.
Yeah.
And my sister will eat that meat. She lives in the Scottish Highlands, so this is a local thing for her. Again, this is a tiny, teeny, tiny percentage. Most people don't live in a place where the guy down the road is going out with his shotgun now to get a deer. But I feel no outrage about that at all. My problem when people are shooting tigers or lions is that there are so few tigers and lions. And I think, it may not be very rational, but I think I do accord an actual moral value to the existence of the species and to the existence of the forest, even if there were no humans left to see it.
Mm. Interesting. Yeah. How much do you care about distant planets and far galaxies?
A lot. I really hate the idea that we
even if nothing will ever experience it.
Well, certainly even if we will never experience it. So I hope there are other inhabited planets of sentience out there, even if we will never meet them or make contact with them. I hope so. I don't like the idea that we are alone in the universe. And I was going to say, I read the book, The World Without Us, which is, which I'll link in the show notes, is a thought experiment about what would happen if humans became extinct. Have you read that book?
Yeah, I haven't read it. I understand the summary, like.
it's an absolutely marvelous book, and I do feel that it would be very sad if humans were to go extinct, and in a sense, it would make things feel meaningless in a way that my own death doesn't make things feel meaningless. And which is something that Darren Brown has talked about a lot, that we actually place more value on the survival of humans as a species than we do on our own survival. Because if you discovered you have some late stage undiagnosed cancer tomorrow, let's hope not, but you would not feel that everything had been meaningless. But if you discovered that an asteroid was heading for Earth and the entirety of humanity was going to be wiped out tomorrow, then I think things would feel meaningless, right?
I'm not sure they would. They certainly wouldn't feel that way for me. Because in a sense, you know, that is a highly likely outcome for the entire human race. And whether it's, you know, tens or hundreds or millions or billions of years, I'm not sure that ending of the species really changes how meaningful our lives are, you know, at the moment. Because again, my focus is on the sentient experience, moment to moment, and the quality of that.
But is
which does impact, which is affected by our anticipation of the future of the species. But
is it the kind of, is it because of how distant it is? Darwin had a kind of crisis. A depressive crisis when he heard about the death of the sun, that our sun is going to go out as a, I think it will become a red giant first and then burn out.
Yes, 4 or 5 billion years, I think. We have some time.
So we have a little time,
and we'll be doing incredibly well if we survive that long.
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping that we will have the technology to go and find another planet before that happens, because it's a while off.
Yeah. And then we're facing the eventual heat death of the universe.
So. Right. So, well, hopefully by then we'll find some way to some way to zip across to a parallel universe and start again there. I kind of hope that our lineage, like our species, will somehow get through, survive. It's partly because, of course, I don't know of any other species with our degree of sentience. And that's why if I knew that the Bajorans and Nobulans and Klingons and whatever were the Minbari or whatever were out there, I would be less upset by the idea of the extinction of our species.
Because sentience is the only thing that matters morally. So as long as there's something out there that's still experiencing, it sort of reassures you.
Yeah, but yeah. I wouldn't be really happy if the something out there still experiencing was just dogs. I mean, much as I love them.
Yeah.
I want a kind of more self-conscious level of experience than that. And I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm monopolizing this conversation too much. I'm sorry. I'm going to ask you some questions from here.
Okay.
This is someone called Patrice asks, sentientism reduces the distance between man and beast and thus makes beasts out of us. Well, it doesn't really do that. It does the opposite, kind of makes persons out of beasts. But he says this is why it was adopted by those with intent to hurt other humans. And I do experience this in India, of course. Many people Many devout Hindus do privilege the lives of cows over those of humans.
Yeah, and particularly when you layered against the caste system.
Well, layered against the caste system as well, but also, you know, a lot of people have been killed for eating beef. And even when those murders were investigated, the police send someone round to the person's house to look in their fridge and send off the meats for any meat found in the fridge for lab testing to see whether they ate beef or not,
yeah.
Which to me is quite irrelevant. The person was murdered.
Yes, absolutely.
It shouldn't even be a factor for consideration.
But I think it's just another example of where supernatural thinking can take you ethically. It can take you to some awful places.
Right. I mean, this is really, I think that has nothing to do with sentientism. So I'm going to just disregard that.
Not really,
that
no.
question.
Because there is a point there where some people talk about historically, some groups of humans have tried to dehumanize people by equating groups of humans with animals and pushing them down to that level to justify evil treatment. Sentientism is trying to do the opposite. It's trying to recognize the power and the richness and the enormous value of human sentience, and actually recognizing as an extension of that, that we're not the only things that are sentient. So we need to improve our treatment of everything else that is sentient. It's bringing people up, not using it as an argument to dehumanize certain human groups. And that's partly why sentientism, in the same, exactly the same way as humanism, is explicitly, it's anti-racist, it's anti-homophobic, it's anti-misogynistic. It's, you know, it looks at sentience as and humanity as a shared, you know, common feature that we can all revel in together, and denies any, you know, discriminatory distinctions.
Okay, all of these questions here on ARI are incredibly long. And
says something about your readership, I think. There were some good questions in there.
Right. I think this one might be good. There is a problem with extending the circle of concern to include sentient animals. They are not in charge of their own lives and destinies. We are. The rights we want to extend to all humans include the right to self-determination. We cannot extend these rights to animals. What would you say to that?
I think it's really interesting. So there's a few different pieces of the architecture here. One is, you mentioned it before, personhood. You know, are animals legal persons in the same way as humans are? There's also the question of rights, you know, and should animals have the same rights as humans? And I absolutely acknowledge that you can distinguish between different, you know, whether animals are counted as persons or not. Maybe you could count some of them and not count others. You would also look at granting rights in different ways because animals have different capabilities and interests from us. I've actually had a go at rewriting the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as a Universal Declaration of Sentient Rights to try and write a document that would cover all of the bases. And I think it works, but you do have to acknowledge that, you know, we have different capabilities and different interests. So not everything would even want the same rights. But again, those are interesting topics, but they're not requirements of sentientism. Sentientism doesn't say all animals have to have legal personhood, and sentientism doesn't have to say all animals have to have the same rights as humans. All it says is we just have to have a base level of moral consideration for them, which means we don't want to cause them unnecessary suffering, in simple terms. So you can hold that view, you could hold that view without granting rights or personhood to animals.
But I think there are a few grey areas here.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, we do think, I mean, I am okay with doing things to animals that I would not do to humans and that are not in the animals' interests and are not what they would choose and may also cause them suffering or diminish their pleasure. Mm. For example, even though dogs are my most valued animal and I would not want to do, I wouldn't even do medical research on dogs, let alone cosmetic research. I wouldn't kill or intentionally harm a dog except in self-defense. And I would not eat dog, even if it had already been killed. And I was very hungry. I would have to be at the point of complete starvation. Even then, I'm not certain that I could bring myself to do that, which is not.
Yeah, and you can see that's another classic example, the annual outrage at the Yulin Dog Meat Festival.
Mm, mm.
You know, people who are tweeting angrily about it are probably sitting down to a pork sausage at the time.
Right, so. And pigs are arguably...
But I agree. I'm with
pigs
you.
Pigs are also very lovely. I have to not watch any pig videos because I eat bacon. And I just, you know, I just run from the cognitive dissonance because pigs are clearly a lovely animal, very intelligent, sweet. You know, they're a little bigger and more impracticable. Otherwise, we would probably have pigs as pets.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you're far from alone. And you know, to be clear, it took me many, many years of cognitive dissonance before I became vegan. So I remind myself of that before I get too preachy. And I still have my own cognitive dissonances now. So
yes.
Anyway, I stopped your flow.
In India, it's very common for people to have been lifelong vegetarians. Most of my friends who are vegetarian in India have never eaten meat or eggs, have never tasted meat or eggs. But I think that's quite rare in the West because in India, it's like a kind of caste thing. You were born into a vegetarian family, you are vegetarian.
Yes, yeah.
But for example, I do think some medical research has to be done on animals. We should not do it on animals if at all possible. And that is becoming increasingly possible to use cell cultures instead. And for teaching, you can now use digital methods and virtual reality and other things. You don't need to be dissecting frogs anymore in class. That's a really good thing. But I think there are some areas in which we still do need to use animals for research. And I'm okay with that.
And humans.
And humans, yeah. Humans are used for research all the time, but without deliberately causing them suffering. So there's the hard boundary.
And they have the agency to choose their involvement often.
Exactly. So in the case of animals, we are A, imprisoning them, and B, deliberately causing them suffering. And although I would like to see that be a last choice option, there are some diseases where I feel it's more important to find a cure for that disease than to prevent the suffering to the individual animals. And I do not feel that way about humans. I agree with Ursula Le Guin in those who walk away from Omelas. If to secure the happiness of our society, we have to keep a child in a darkened room under constant torture, then we should let our society go to hell.
But
I do think that we could.
Wonderful author.
Yeah. So there's. I clearly have a moral differentiation that I'm making there.
Mm.
Also, you know, even though I really love dogs, I'm okay with people castrating dogs and with and spaying bitches. And I'm not okay with forced sterilization of humans.
Yeah.
There may be some edge. Yeah, there may be some extreme edge cases again.
There will be people who class themselves as sentientists who will fall on both sides of those debates, because what we're not saying is causing any suffering in circumstances is completely unacceptable. That's not the position. The position is you just have to have moral consideration for anything that can suffer. And sometimes causing suffering may well still be justified with humans and with animals. And again, you know, there are many and complex and varied debates where you can either apply rules or a utilitarian perspective to try and come up with some conclusion. I'm open-minded to the debate around all of those things, as long as everything that is capable of suffering is at least granted some moral consideration. And again, that brings us back to, you know, hence, yes, there are debates around medical research. Yes, there are debates around, you know, some small-scale, very serious causes of suffering. But there are also some massive industrial-scale, deliberate, blinding things we're doing right now, which are causing industrial scale unnecessary suffering that are the priority.
Right.
But it's, you know, sometimes suffering is justified, and sometimes causing suffering and even death is the right thing to do with humans and with animals.
I would also say that there is again a difference in the degree to which I see animals versus humans as individuals. And so, for example, if there are only a few members of a species left, if we can breed them in captivity, I would like to see them in captivity in a zoo. Though those animals are utterly miserable in the zoo, are leading miserable lives, as many zoo animals do, I'm sure. Nevertheless, I would rather they're in a zoo, and if we can breed them in the zoo. If we can't breed them, let them go free and enjoy their lives. But I would rather the species survive at the expense of those individuals suffering. Whereas, for example, if there were, I don't know, only four Maoris left, and we could ensure that the continuation of that racial group by putting them in a cage and keeping them as breeding specimens, I would be aghast at that. And it's one of the things that I always feel when people are talking about white genocide, quote unquote white genocide. You know that.
Yes. Well, apparently, I mean, so I've lived in London for 25 years, and some people on Twitter seem absolutely stunned that I've survived the white genocide that apparently is going on, despite its complete absence of appearance in any of the official statistics and my personal experience.
But even if it were the case that, for example, people with blue eyes were dying out, there are fewer and fewer of them, or redheads or something, the implication is that we should somehow force people with blue eyes to breed, it's a mindset that implicitly regards humans as breeding stock, and I absolutely disagree with that. However, if it's a rare animal, then yes, I do under certain circumstances regard them primarily as breeding stock, and the main thing is keeping the species alive, because once it's extinct, we have no way, as far as we can foresee, we will never have a way of getting them back.
Yeah.
And that's a difference in morals. I agree.
But I don't think there's an intrinsic value in scarcity. I think if there's a rare animal species that might have some future value in environmental services through biodiversity or medical research or something similar, you know, then there would be a justification. Otherwise, you know, I don't see there being any intrinsic moral value in a species, but I do see there being intrinsic moral worth in the, you know, the surviving the last surviving animals. But I think it's a, you know, it's an interesting but somewhat minor question.
That's interesting.
Would it be interesting to talk a little bit about how people in the humanist community think of sentientism? Because that's been quite an interesting dynamic.
Yes, please do.
Yeah. So I've had some fascinating conversations with many humanists when I've been talking about sentientism and building a community around it. And also had some conversations with people who are current and historic leaders of some of the international and national humanist organizations. And the responses have been many and varied. So interestingly, when you look at, for example, Humanists UK or the International Humanists and Ethical Association, which is the global organization, in their definition of humanism, they already include a concern for other sentient animals. So many humanists, and anecdotally, it seems that a much higher proportion of humanists are already vegetarian or vegan than in the general population. And I think that is because they already have a commitment to evidence and reason. They have a commitment to a broad moral compassion. Some of them know that humanism is even defined to extend that concern to sentient animals. Hence, you know, more of them are vegetarian or vegan. So those people who are already in that space love the idea of sentientism because it takes all of the power and the value of humanism and the rational value of humanism and the compassion of humanism, and it just simply extends it to the other things that are capable of experiencing suffering. So those people have seized on it and said, this is great, I've got a name for the way I've always thought. So that's been refreshing and positive. There's another group of humanists, and these are quite rare, who actually use humanism and the fact that the species is in the name to justify dominion over other animals. So they say, no, this is about human supremacy. Our species is the only one that is a moral object and that deserves consideration. And that's where the line should be drawn. And they say that despite, you know, the definitions used by the International Humanist Union. But they're reasonably rare. There's another group of humanists that agree with the philosophy of sentientism. They think it's more coherent because it focuses on sentience. They like the fact it's very clear that it's not species bound, whereas the name humanism implies that. But for pragmatic reasons, they're very nervous about fragmenting humanism or distracting from its purpose breaking a chain of traditionally powerful and valuable thinking around humanism as well. So there's a wide variety of different views. But most humanists are like everybody else, right? They apply evidence and reason, certainly in the sphere of religion and the supernatural, in that most of these humanist organizations are explicitly non-theistic. They apply broad compassion to humans and to some degree to animals, but having cognitive dissonance and hypocrisy as most of the population, and that they don't then take that step through to their personal and institutional behaviors. And you can see that when you look at what humanist organizations focus on. They nearly all of their campaigns are focused on the human species. I haven't found one that has a policy that even talks about animal farming. And their focus, understandably, is largely around resisting religious privilege and pushing for a secular state, which is something I fully agree with and subscribe to, and that's why I'm a member of some of these organizations. But the name of the philosophy, humanism, the focus of the campaigns, and the fact that most of their members don't take that concern for other sentient animals seriously implies to me that we do need sentientism to formally and explicitly and clearly stretch that moral consideration a little bit further. And whether it becomes a sort of rearguard rebellious movement within humanism that pushes humanism's boundaries further, or whether it's a distinct movement, I'm not really that interested. But it's been fascinating to have those conversations with a range of different humanists, some who've seized on the idea and are very positive about it, but a few who seem to have ironically almost religious resistance to extending our moral consideration beyond the human species. That's a bit of a monologue, but it's been interesting to see the variety of responses.
No, that's excellent. I'm aware that this has been quite a long episode, and you have been so generous with your time. Jamie, thank you so much.
That's a pleasure. It's been lovely to talk to you.
And I know that I have blethered on rather too much during this interview, more than usual. but I didn't think I was interested in this topic, actually. But as soon as I began talking about it, my interest just grew.
I'm glad to hear it.
It's very personal. You know, it does tackle very personal things and attitudes. And so I think almost everyone has a view about it.
Yeah. And to me, the most important thing here, I mean, this isn't just about animal rights. It's not about veganism. It's not about religion. The most fundamental thing is it's about a recommitment to evidence and reason. And it has that in common with humanism. So it has implications for, you know, almost everything we try and face as a human race or as a, you know, a wider group of species. If you apply evidence and reason, we have a better chance of fixing all of our problems. And whether it's, you know, post-truth politicians, whether it's, you know, Orwellian behavior by some of those people who are supposed to be leading us, whether it's the behavior of theocratic states or the influence of supernatural or unfounded conspiracy theory on areas of human health and human rights, you know, the list goes on. I mean, I wrote a somewhat contentious list of what would disappear from the world if everyone was a sentientist, and it covers almost every aspect of our lives. This isn't, you know, some sort of niche thing about animal rights. It has much broader implications than that if we take it seriously. And that's partly why I've found it so fascinating and why I've made it a somewhat amateur personal project to raise awareness of it, because it feels timely, it feels important, but it's very, you know, it's very unknown at this point. So
great. Well, thank you for drawing our attention to it, Jamie.
It's a pleasure. And if people want to find out more, I think I've sent you some of the, you know, there's obviously the article I did in Area, which hopefully serves as a good intro, but we're building some global community around it now as well. So we're on Twitter, we have a private group on Facebook, we're on Reddit, we have a Goodreads site, there's all sorts. So there's probably people from, interestingly, over 50 countries involved in these different groups so far, from every single continent, and a massive diversity of perspectives, which has been really heartening to see people getting involved. And there's, you know, they're philosophers, they're academics, they're policy people, they're writers, but most of the people involved are just interested lay people like me. So anyone who's interested in finding out more, feel free to reach out.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much. I'll put all the links that you sent me to those organizations in the show notes. And thank you so much for joining me, Jamie.
It's been a real pleasure.
And I'm going to do a little bit of housekeeping at the end of this episode. I apologize that there was no podcast last Sunday. Unfortunately, I had technical problems in my interview with Eric Kaufman, the author of White Shift, and I will be interviewing Eric in written format, and I will send all the patrons a link to that, and probably using Letter. Letter is a new social media app / website, but it is a way for individuals to write letters to each other publicly, but one-on-one, without the distraction and the gladiatorial atmosphere of Twitter, without the likes and random comments, so that we can explore things in a slightly longer form, but without writing an article, in a way that is more spontaneous than writing an article and is personal. So we're going to be talking directly to each other one-on-one as we would in real life, but publicly. You can share the resulting conversations on Twitter and Facebook, and we will be publishing the conversation of the week and a small article about that conversation in Aereo each week. So if you would like if you write a good conversation, it may appear in Aereo. We will, of course, remunerate you, as we always do for our writers. Please go and check out letter.wiki. And I also want to give a quick shout out to Justin Ward, who is the babeliest babe of Canada and my sound engineer, and who is the most professional, generous, and wonderful person. Thank you so much, Justin. And thank you, Jamie, for joining us.
A real pleasure.
And have a lovely week, everyone. You've been listening to Two for Tea, the accompanying podcast for Aereo magazine. Aereo is a non-partisan political and cultural digital magazine with a universal liberal humanist slant, edited by Helen Pluckrose with the assistance of sub-editor yours truly. At Aereo, we hope to counter the current atmosphere of frenzied partisanship and hysteria with calm, well-reasoned articles and civil discussions. Both Aereo and Two for Tea are entirely audience supported. You, our readers and listeners, make these conversations possible. You can support the magazine, the podcast, or both on Patreon. Look for Aereo, A-R-E-O, A for Apple, R for Robert, E for Edward, O for Orange, and Two for Tea. All patrons will get access to free monthly patron-only podcasts and other perks. Plus, by becoming a patron, you will keep these platforms alive and flourishing. Two for Tea is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and all other podcast subscription sites. If you're listening on a podcast app, take a moment to hit that subscriber button. Give us a rating. Write us a brief review, even just a couple of words. Spread the news. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful week.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?